You're listening to Sounds Good on WKMS. It's our midday music and community conversation program. I'm Tracy Ross here in the studio with Kate Lochte and Murray State's MFA and Creative Writing Program Director, Ann Nealon. Ann, thanks for coming back on Sounds Good.
Thank you.
And I like to think of you as one of the treasures in our community, and I'd like to share a little bit about your background with our listeners. Anne's a native of Boston and a former Peace Corps volunteer in West Africa. She's a graduate of the MFA program at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and the author of the book Easter Vigil, which earned the Anne Hinga Prize for Poetry and the RPCV Writers and Readers Award. She's been a Wallace Stegner Fellow as well as a Jones Lecturer in Poetry at Stanford University. She's the winner of an Al Smith Fellowship from the Kentucky Arts Council and fellowships from the Kentucky Foundation for Women, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Yaddo Artists Colony. Your poems and translations have appeared in many magazines, including the American Poetry Review, Ironwood, the Gettysburg Review, and Manoa. Welcome.
Thank you, Kate. It's good to be here in this season.
Well, here's the setup. Anne, we chatted a week or so ago and said, Anne, think about poems that you'd like to hear during holiday run-up. And so it's all yours.
Well, thank you, Kate. I thought I'd start out rather traditionally with, I guess, what you could classify as a manger scene. This is a poem. It's called The Oxen by Thomas Hardy, and it's one that I first encountered in college when the dean of my college gave me a Christmas book. I guess it was given to all English majors with, you know, great Christmas poems in it. I did try to locate it for this gig here, but I couldn't put my fingers on it. But I remember thinking in college that this was kind of an easy poem, you know, thinking, oh, just a little manger, you know, kind of like away in a manger. But I don't think that anymore. You know, for one thing, Thomas Hardy, I mean, we often talk about him as the father of modern poetry, and not just because of when he came about in the 19th century, but also because of his kind of skepticism and doubt, which kind of led him into the modern era, or led us into the modern era, you know, existentialism and beyond. And he wrote this poem when he was 75 years old, long after he had disavowed his, you know, beliefs in practice of Christianity. But he did, you know, always write with truth about the Dorset folk, you know, that he grew up with. And I think he also, you know, did kind of have some vestiges of Christianity. And I think what I value in the poem is just, you know, the thinking about that struggle with belief and doubt. And, you know, everybody thinks belief is easy, but it really isn't. But here's an old man looking back on a practice of his Dorset countryside folk when he was younger. And the practice was, after midnight mass, to go to the manger and see the animals. And often there was something miraculous happening with the animals. I guess it would be sort of like, you know, today we look at tortillas and see Jesus' face, or look at the church walls and see the Virgin's tears. Well, that's the equivalent here. A couple of things I should gloss. There's an adjective in here. It's like straw with a Y, strawy. And then there are a couple of words we don't use at all anymore. They're Dorset words. Barton, which is a farmyard, and coombe, which is deep valley. So here's The Oxen by Thomas Hardy. Christmas Eve and 12 of the clock. Now they are all on their knees, an elder said, as we sat in a flock by the embers in hearthside ease. We pictured the meek, mild creatures where they dwelt in their strawy pen, nor did it occur to one of us there to doubt they were kneeling then. So fair a fancy few would weave in these years. Yet I feel, if someone said on Christmas Eve, Come, see the oxen kneel in the lonely barton by yonder coombe our childhood used to know. I should go with him in the gloom, hoping it might be so. It's kind of like how the people become like animals too. You know, the people are sitting in a flock. Mm-hmm. So there's one, and I think you know the next poem is definitely the hardest one I'm going to read, and I wasn't going to read it because I thought maybe it might be too hard. But then I heard your coverage this morning, you know, kind of preparation for the anniversary of the Newtown massacre, and I heard the parents of one of the children.
We were seeking a scientific answer to how something like this could have happened.
Right, right. And it just really got to me, as I'm sure it got to all mm-hmm. of the WKMS listeners. So I thought I'd read this poem, which harkens back to our experience as a nation in the Vietnam War. But the connection with Christmas is that the poet is Denise Levertov, and she's really fusing two things here, those kind of napalm images of children. And there was a very famous one that most of us, all of us really of a certain age, will know for sure, the girl, you know, kind of walking mm-hmm. toward the cameraman. She's juxtaposing that with Southwell, you know, British writer's kind of mystical vision of the burning babe, which is associated with Christmas, and the two, it's kind of like cognitive dissonance. So both of those things are going on. And, you know, Levertov is also someone who is very influenced by the German poet Rainer Maria Rilke. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he really believed that, you know, the purpose of a poet was to sing. You know, he wrote sonnets to Orpheus, and you know the Orphic vision was really, really big for him, and I think it is to her. And it's really, this poem's really about her struggle to be a poet and to sing in the face of what she sees. Here we go. Advent, 1966. Because in Vietnam, the vision of a burning babe is multiplied, the flesh on fire, not Christ's, as Southwell saw it, prefiguring the passion upon the eve of Christmas, but wholly human and repeated, infant after infant, their names forgotten, their sex unknown in the ashes, set alight, flaming but not vanishing, not vanishing as his vision, but lingering, cinders upon the earth, or living on, moaning and stinking in hospitals, three abed. Because of this, my strong sight, my clear, caressive sight, my poet's sight I was given that it might stir me to song, is blurred. There is a cataract filming over my inner eyes, or else a monstrous insect has entered my head and looks out from my sockets with multiple vision, seeing not the unique, holy infant burning sublimely, an image of redemption, furnace in which souls are wrought into new life, but as off a belt line, more senseless figures aflame. And this insect, who is not there, it is my own eyes do my seeing, the insect is not there, what I see is there, will not permit me to look elsewhere, or if I look, to see, except dulled and unfocused, the delicate, firm, whole flesh of the still unburned. As I said, that's really one of the more difficult Christmas poems going. But I don't think, you know, Christmas is all about, you know, silver tinseled Christmas tree. You know, to kind of pick up on a poem I didn't read or choose to read this time around. You know, Lawrence Ferlinghetti's Getty's When Christ Climbed Down. You know, many listeners might know that poem that would kind of goes through a litany of all the mm-hmm. kind of typical Christmas images and gets to the real infant at the end, and I think this is maybe a harder poem about getting to the meaning of Christmas.
As an adult, I never thought of the pictures of the infant with the halo glow around even resembled fire. It never struck me, but one of our colleagues here, if you recall, Tracy, I think Jeremy McKeel's little boy, in fact, came back from church one day and asked why they were frying Jesus.
Oh, wow. That's great. Speaking of tortillas, tortillas on tortillas.
So listen, I don't mean to stop you at all, but it came to mind when the image came up.
Sure.
And I thank you for sharing that one with us.
Well, the next one I'm going to read because I was a huge fan of Seamus Heaney, you know, still am, but Seamus Heaney died this year, and it's a great loss to the poetry world, not just because he was a great poet, but because he was an incredibly generous man and kind to other artists, no matter what their age or reputation. And I'm going to read a poem called An Ulster Twilight. And, of course, Ulster is the setting of all the troubles in Northern Ireland and, you know, that there are Catholics and Protestants in Ulster, and twilight is a bad time because it's in between night and day, and the safe time is going, you know, night's coming on. I know we had Northern Irish poet, Belfast poet Kieran Carson here on campus a few years ago, and he talked about how his father was a postman and what a dangerous job it was, you know, which was kind of shocking. We think of being a postman as, you know, a pretty great job in terms of safety. But, you know, I because of the you know, conflict between Catholics and Protestants, it was really a rough job. And I remember I gave him the address of my pen pal I had when I was in eighth grade, you know, seventh, eighth, and ninth grades, 45 Blacks Road, and he immediately said, "Catholic, that's a Catholic." You know, the postman kind of had to, the postman's son, too, I guess, had to kind of memorize addresses.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah. But this, you know, here what Seamus Heaney does is kind of memorialize a moment when he was a kid sleeping or, you know, trying to sleep on Christmas evening, and his Christmas present was delivered by the person who made it, who was a Protestant, you know, and he was the son of a Protestant policeman, you know. So there's this, you know, really positive interaction in which I guess you might think about in terms of Christmas in the midst of this. And it does make me think of Christmas, too, and that, you know, Seamus Heaney is always very good about evoking, you know, details of the landscape and, you know, things as well. And he does a great job here, I think, of evoking a carpenter's shop, you know, which makes me think of St. Joseph and, you know, Christmas. This poem is from a book called Station Island, in which he wrote, there's a place in Ireland called Station Island, you know, where there are a lot of pilgrimages. And so that was kind of the poem that trumped, the title poem trumped that book, but this is another one that's kind of caught on, you know, and it's quiet voice here. Okay. And I should say, too, that there are two levels of time here. There's, you know, Seamus Heaney, or the person that kind of stands up for Seamus Heaney here as a boy waiting on that Christmas evening, and then 15 years later he's looking back on the incident with a more adult sense of what went on. In Ulster twilight, the bare bulb, a scatter of nails, shelved timber, glinting chisels, in a shed of corrugated iron, Eric Dawson stoops to his plane at 5 o'clock on a Christmas Eve. Carpenter's pencil next, the spoke shave, fret saw, auger, rasp, and all, a rub with a rag of linseed oil. A mile away it was taking shape, the hulk of a toy battleship. As water buckets iced and frost hardened the quiet on roof and post. Where is he now? There were 15 years between us two. That night I strained to hear the bells of a sleigh of the mind and heard him pedal into our lane, get off at the gable, steady his Raleigh bicycle against the whitewash, stand to make sure the house was quiet, knock at the door, and hand his parcel to a peering woman. I suppose you thought I was never coming. Eric, tonight I saw it all, like shadows on your workshop wall, smelled wood shavings under the bench, weighed the cold steel monkey wrench in my soft hand, then stood at the road to watch your wavering taillight fade, and knew that if we met again in an Ulster twilight, we would begin and end whatever we might say in a speech all toys and carpentry, a doorstep courtesy to shun your father's uniform and gun. But now that I have said it out, maybe none the worse for that. I think, you know, you might wonder why he names a person Eric Gosset, but I think that's kind of code too. Anyone who's Irish would know that's a Protestant name, you know, and so he didn't have to hit people over the head with the situation.
I'm still stuck on a sleigh of the mind.
Oh, right, right. That's a great line. Yeah, rest in peace, Seamus Heaney. He was one of the greats for sure. Another of the greats in my mind is Czesław Miłosz, Polish poet, and another Nobel laureate. Although Miłosz got the Nobel Prize quite a few years before Heaney did. Miłosz was really an incredible witness. You know, he was there for the Warsaw Ghetto. You know, he wrote out of Europe, Poland in flames, basically. And I think that you know, for a while there, I know for a while he because he was young and really didn't have any other choices, he became part of the government, you might say, you know, as kind of an attaché to the government. But then he just really couldn't personally, morally stick around, given what was going on, given the all the freedoms that had been revoked, and all that. And he became probably the most famous exile poet. He was at the University of California, Berkeley, for many, many years. And in his last few years, he did move back to Krakow. One of his more famous poems, Dedication, sort of talks about how when he was in Paris, he saw all these people who were learning to be rational, and he kind of talks about people like, say, Pol Pot, who studied in, at a higher level, but then went back to Cambodia and were very systematic and decimating their people. He really is somebody who doesn't believe in rationalism as an end. He said, for example, it is impossible to communicate to people who have not experienced it, the undefinable menace of total rationalism. In the wake of the real decimation of everything he knew in the war, he went back in some of his most famous poems to the most simple images of his childhood, and he talks about them as if they were almost like holy cards. He kind of had to write that through before he got to writing about other things. It was a way of fighting back to some kind of belief. But this is a poem he wrote, I guess, kind of taking on all the people who think about angels as fluff, Christmas fluff, and maybe that's all of us. But I think he gets to the power that maybe is set up against, in his mind, against rationality, the power of mystical experience, religious experience. he was a believer, and unlike many poets who teach in university, I mean, he was not somebody who was teaching workshops. You know, he was teaching courses on like Stoicism and things. I mean, he was just an amazing, you know, philosophical mind. Okay, On Angels, Czesław Miłosz. All was taken away from you, white dresses, wings, even existence. Yet I believe in you, messengers. There, where the world is turned inside out, a heavy fabric embroidered with stars and beasts, you stroll, inspecting the trustworthy seams. Short is your stay here. Now and then, at a matinal hour, if the sky is clear, in a melody repeated by a bird, or in the smell of apples at close of day, when the light makes the orchards magic. They say somebody has invented you. But to me, this does not sound convincing, for the humans invented themselves as well. The voice, no doubt it is a valid proof, as it can belong only to radiant creatures, weightless and winged. After all, why not, girdled with the lightning? I have heard that voice many a time when asleep, and what is strange, I understood more or less an order or an appeal in an unearthly tongue. Day draw near, another one, do what you can. I guess that's, you know, maybe his way of saying, you know, a lie. It always makes me think, you know, nothing is impossible with God, that kind of, you know, this sort of visionary presence that you choose to either take into your life or not, you know, and suffer the consequences. But as I say, for him, I mean, religion was a very, very powerful force. And I think he, at least in the early days, he suffered much criticism in the academy for being as devout as he was. And but he was, you know, an incredible, you know, witness. And you know, he's written prose about the experiences he had in World War II. As well, he may be known more for The Native Realm, which is a very famous book he wrote.
And you've really brought gifts today to WKMS.
Well, thanks, Kate.
I'm hopeful that all of you listening have enjoyed a respite. I appreciate your being here. Ann Neeland directs Murray State's MFA in Creative Writing, and is it fair to say you're responsible for the publication of the New Madrid Journal?
Yes, yes. I am the editor of it, and I work with Jackie Day, who used to work at WKMS. She's our managing editor, and Delray Phillips is our fiction editor, and Riley Hanick, our new Watkins Fellow, is our nonfiction editor. And it's been great working with Riley for the first time around for this issue.
Coming out when?
In January, and it's on. It's called The Great Hunger, and it's really, you know, kind of going back to the Irish famine, which kind of came out of a panel that I was on rewriting The Great Hunger at the Associated Writing Programs conference in Boston. But it's really about applying the famine to the situation today, too. You know, we were thinking about getting some pieces that maybe resonated with hunger in the United States today. As you know, probably listeners know, you know, we've got a backpack program in Callaway County. We have, you know, which kind of indicates that, you know, food insecurity in our midst. You know, we're talking about, you know, the food stamp program being cut. I mean, there are a lot of issues that are related to hunger right now. The growing and scarily growing gap between the rich and the poor, and so we have a number of pieces of fiction, nonfiction, poetry. We have an interview with T.J. English, who's the guy who wrote on the Irish mob and all that. You know, so I think it'll be a good issue.
We'll look forward to that.
Great.
And I hope you'll visit with more from the next issue of the New Madrid Journal. And Tracy, we'll go back to music with you.